Erev Tov, everybody. Just before we start with officially, I'll put in for those who haven't registered yet for our program on Sunday, please do so either right now or at 9:30 after we end the shiur. But really, I think we have, unfortunately, a relevant program. 9 speakers this Sunday, not 9:15 Eastern till 2:15. Most of the speakers live in Israel, but anyways, that's this Sunday. I'm sure you've seen the emails, but I just put the registration in line, and it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Aaron Kohler, to welcome him back to Torah in Motion, and to welcome him back from Cambridge, where he spent the last year, and he was a fellow at Cambridge, and he was a visiting scholar at the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies. I assume now he's back at Yeshiva University in his quote-unquote his regular job, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Yeshiva University. He is the author of Unbinding Yitzchak Isaac. That book came up recently about the Akedah, the significance of the Akedah for modern Jewish thought. And he taught a couple years ago, I'm sure some of you were being there, he taught a 6-part series on Megillat Esther at 9 in the morning, I believe. We did that series. And he wrote a book on Megillat Esther. And really, author, professor, and a friend, I'll say. And it's a pleasure to welcome him back to Torah Motion. Vakasha, Dr. Kohler.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. Although one of the things I like being here is that you don't do introductions, so I feel a little betrayed, but anyway, it's good to be here. Thank you.
I'm sorry?
I said, usually you don't do introductions, so I...
No, I don't do introductions when we have these long programs, like on Tisha B'Av or like on Sunday, because we don't have time, but when you're a standalone, we'll do it the first time. It's here the first time, but okay. Now, enough of the introduction. Now,
excellent.
Torah Mamish. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you. Yes, very good to be here. Let me share my screen. And we will get started because this is important stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So we have Parshat Mishpatim. First time the name Kishmo Kein Hu. The name tells you it's the first parsha that's chock full of laws. It's not the first mitzvot in the Torah, of course, but first one that is beginning to end almost entirely laws, and there's all sorts of literary questions that the laws raise. We can read laws in different ways. You can read laws as laws. So you open the New York State or the, I don't know, Ontario, there must be some code of law up there. It's not like New Jersey where everything's permitted, so there's probably like a code of law. And you can open it up and you're trying to find out what to do. What am I allowed to do? What do I have to do? What am I not allowed to do? That's one way of reading laws. It is patently obvious that that is not what the Torah wants you to do with laws in the Torah. It's a ineffectual code of laws. There are many things that you will simply never learn, no matter how many times you read the laws in the Torah. I will not learn at all how to get married. I wouldn't want to learn how to get divorced, but I couldn't learn it if I wanted to. All sorts of realms of halacha that are simply missing in the Torah if we approach it as a guidebook for what to do. It doesn't mean that the laws are not laws, but it means that they have clearly been selected, arranged from out of a body of possible laws. So, of course, that leads to questions of why does the Torah start, for example, the Ramban asks the question, why does our Parsha start with the law of Eved Ivri? It seems like a strange place to start. And the Ramban says, well, it makes sense, actually, when you think about the context. They just got out of Mitzrayim. They were just slaves. Immediately, this transition to thinking about what does it mean to treat a slave nicely. We might wish, we from our 21st century North American perspective, might wish that the Torah had gone further and said, now that you know what it's like to be a slave, you shouldn't have slaves. I'm not going to try to answer that question directly tonight, but I think that Ben Ashitin, in what we talk about this evening, we'll also see that when we talk about slavery in the Torah, it's an entirely different ballgame than when we talk about slavery in some other cultures, or at least much of the time, not unfortunately all the time. But why does it go from one law to another? Why are these laws in and not other laws? These are literary questions about the laws in the Torah. They're very important questions because the Torah is clearly selected and organized the laws in a certain way. And presumably there is significance to that. If we read only one pasuk at a time, and this is, you know, to some extent an educational question. So certainly when I was a kid, we learned, you know, pasuk at a time. I rarely had a sense as a child of the broader context of a particular pasuk, like what's been going on in this perek. That's very hard to hard to keep in mind when you're doing one pasuk and sort of, making sure you understand every word and every Rashi. The flow of the text often gets lost. But even with regard to something like Mishpatim, that flow of the text is very, very important. So that's what we're going to try to talk about today. I am. This is going to be. We're going to be drawing on academic methods and insights. And so I'll just say very, very quickly what I mean by academic methods of biblical studies. Biblical studies. So primarily, it's what in traditional terms is called pshat, as opposed to, let's say, the rest of Pardes and other methods. And what do we mean by pshat? Well, first of all, we mean context, context, context. Meaning, to understand the text properly means to understand it in its literary context. It has to make sense in the pasuk before it, the pasuk after it, and what we'll talk more about this evening. It has to make sense in the historical context. So we have to make sure that what we're saying in terms of understanding a pasuk fits what the situation, the historical situation, the legal situation, the socioeconomic situation of 3,000 years ago in the Near East. If our interpretation fits really well in medieval Europe or in contemporary North America, but is entirely inappropriate for the ancient Near East, then something's gone wrong. We're not doing a good pshat approach to Tanakh. Another feature of academic study of Tanakh is using all available sources. So I'm not going to actually talk a lot about sources this evening, but I'll say up front that when we think about slavery, when we think about what is a slave, we actually do have a lot of sources from the ancient Near East outside of Tanakh. We have dozens and dozens, maybe even hundreds of oh, definitely hundreds of slave documents from Mesopotamia, contracts written for the purchase of a slave, for the transfer of a slave, for the manumission of a slave, the freeing of a slave. So we can really piece together what slavery was like in the ancient Near East. Of course, what we know about Mesopotamia is not necessarily what was going on in Israel, but it can give us information. So using those sources, that's something that academics do really well, that traditional study has typically done less well. And then the fourth thing that I put here is source criticism. And this is actually, to some extent, the focal point of the shiur this evening. Source criticism is a method of studying, especially the Torah, that says, oh, when you read the Torah as a whole, I have all sorts of questions, but I can answer those questions by dissolving the Torah into its constituent parts. So there's, of course, a theory here that the Torah comes from different parts that have been joined together in its current form. But there is no answer to how this parsha goes with that parsha or this pasuk goes with that pasuk. The answer is that they're contradictory, and the only explanation is that they're originally disagreeing and they happen to be in the same book, but we make a mistake by reading together. Now, that in a sense is supposed to be the result of a pshat approach, but it's taken on a life of its own. And I'm sure many of you know this, that in academic circles, source criticism is sometimes a dogma almost. So I want to use tonight's example to talk a little bit about a case which is actually held up often as one of the primary cases, primary examples of where source criticism is necessary, and try to show you that actually, when we think about context, when we think about using all the sources, when we think about a pshat reading, a lot of the alleged questions that lead to a source critical approach actually fall away. So that's what we're going to talk about this evening. Okay, so let me start with some of the questions. The claim is that there are inconsistencies in the Torah's slave laws. And I don't say that the claim is, but we'll see that this is true. So for example, the slave who's there for 6 years, so Shmot, meaning Parsha Mishpatim, what we're going to have this Parsha, the six-year slave, is that only for men? Or can a woman be a six-year slave also? Shmot says only men. Woman, different law. We get to Devarim, and Devarim says also women. We'll see this in more detail in a couple of minutes. I'm just going to put these questions out as things that I want you to be looking out for as we look at the psukim inside. Another inconsistency. How long is a slave? 6 years? That's what Shmot and Devarim say. Or until Yovel, as it says in Vayikra and Behar. Where is a slave marked if a slave is going to stay more than 6 years? Does that happen at the Elohim or Elokim, depending on what that is, as it says in Shemot, or at the door, as it says in Devarim. And are there gifts upon exit? Ha'anakah, it says in Devarim, but doesn't say anywhere else. So these are all inconsistencies, right? We read, I guess I should say it first, or maybe I don't have to say now. I can't say it first anymore, that there are laws of Evid Ivri three places in the Torah, in Mishpatim, and then again in Vayikra Chafhei, in Parashat Behar, and then again in Devarim Tet Zayin. So a literary question is, why are the three places that the Torah talks about Evid Ivri? Why can't the Torah just give us all of the halachot that we need at one point, at one time? I'm not going to give a full answer to that, but I hopefully will give you some food for thinking about that. That would certainly make a good amount of sense if we assume that the Torah's purpose was to give us all the laws that we need in order to know how to operate a slave economy. Since I'm going to try to convince you tonight that that's not the Torah's purpose in these slave laws, that question takes on a different air. But having noticed that there are three different types, then we start looking for inconsistencies and we find them really easily. So let's take these one at a time, and we're going to work through each of them fairly quickly, and then we're going to step back and talk about what we find when we try to put them together next to each other, what happens when we look at them. Look at these inconsistencies. Okay, so this is our parsha. It's a good place to start. So, of course, the first pasuk is Eileh Mishpatim. And then we get to, Ki tikne eved ivri, sheish shanim ya'avod, uvashvi'it yetzei lo chofshi chinam. So when you acquire or buy an eved ivri, he shall work for 6 years and go out lachofshi. I'm going to leave some words untranslated because they actually are really interesting and important, but also require more time than we have this evening. La chofshi, they go out, let's say, to freedom, although chofshi is a weird word for freedom, chinam, with nothing, just with grace. Im begapo yavo, begapo yetze, if he comes in with his body alone, he goes out with his alone. Im baalisha, hu v'yatza ishto imo, if he's married to a woman, then his wife goes out with him. If his master gives him a wife, so while he's a slave, his master provides a wife, presumably from, this is the pshat, but it's also how Chazal take it, presumably from a woman whom the master owns already, presumably a non-Jewish slave, then when the Eved Ivri goes to freedom, he goes out by himself, Bigapo. The woman and her children remain enslaved to the master. So that then raises the following case. Imamor Yomar Ha'eved, Ahavti et Adoni et Ishti vet Banai, Lo etzei chofshi. Slave says, I don't want to go free. If that's what it means, I have to go, I'm giving up my wife and giving up my children. I got to go free, but I don't have this life anymore. I don't want to go. Lo etzei chofshi. Then there is a ceremony for that. V'gisho Adonav el Elohim, v'gisho al ha-delet o al ha-mezuzah, v'ratza Adonav et ozno b'marzeah v'avodo le'olam. So the master shall have him approach the Elohim, and he should have him approach the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl, and then he shall serve him forever. Law 1. Law 2. V'chiyim korish ish et bitola ama. If a man sells his daughter to be a maidservant, an ama, she shall not go out the way that the slaves, apparently the male slaves, go out. If she is bad in the eyes of her master, to whom she was betrothed, and who redeemed her, he shall not hand her over for control to a foreign people in his betrayal of her. I'm leaving that literally translated, but unexplained. V'im livno yi adena, kimishpat habanot yasela. If he betroths her, matches her up with his son, then he has to do for her like the law of young ladies. And even if he marries another, he may not deprive her of these three, the she'erek sutva onah, which big machloket rishonim about what it means exactly, but sexual relations, clothes, and food. Im shlosh ela lo yaselah, if he doesn't do these three for her, v'yatzah chinam ein kasef, then she goes out for free, no money involved. So quick summary here of what we just saw. We have two laws. Part one, the Eved Ivri, works 6 years, goes out chofshi, comes in alone, goes out alone, comes married, wife goes out with him. The case of marrying while indentured, then the wife and children remain indentured. And then there's the option of staying beyond year six with this ear piercing thing. Then we had the second law, the case of the Amah. A girl sold by her father as an Amah, she does not go out the same way as the Abadim. Even if she's not favored by the master, he may not sell her. She's betrothed to the master's son, be treated with the same laws as any other bride. Even if he marries another, must provide sherek suta and onah, and otherwise she goes free for no payment. All right, so those are our two laws here at the beginning of Mishpatim. We turn a few pages in our Chumashim, da-da-da-da, we get to Vayikra Chafhei, starting in Vayikra Chafhei, so this is Bahar Sinai, and you know what Bahar Sinai starts with, because Rashi has a incredibly famous question at the beginning of Bahar Sinai, right? Ma'inyan Shemitah etel Har Sinai, right? So Bahar starts with the rules of Shemitah. And the first half of Perek Chafhei describes the rules of Shemitah, the rules of Yovel. Now, Shemitah and Yovel, as is sort of obvious, are economically challenging, right? Can you imagine every 7 years just making no money, like no income whatsoever? So Rabbi Kalman mentioned that I was on sabbatical last year. So I'm in one of these weird jobs that actually gives sabbaticals every 7 years, right? As if we were living in a biblical society. But there's a trick. I get paid. Farmers, if they don't plant anything for a year, don't get paid. So how do you go every 7 years and not get paid at all? And then Yovel, 2 years in a row, no income whatsoever. So the first half of the Perek just describes Shemitah and Yovel in this sort of idyllic world where everyone observes Shemitah, here's the rules of it. Here, everyone observes Yovel, here's the rules of it. The second half of the Perek, beginning in Pasuk Chaf Hei, things start to go wrong. And we'll look a little bit more at this in a few minutes, but things start to go wrong. What does that mean? Well, then it's the Torah introduces a case of what happens if Yamuch Achicha imach, your kinsman, becomes destitute alongside you, right? It's not going so well. Maybe it's because of Shemitah or Yovel. Maybe it's just because farming is actually an unpredictable profession. And even if most of the time it works well, a bad year here and there is unavoidable. So what if your kinsman, something goes wrong and he sells his field? Now, remember, this is an agricultural society. No one sells their field voluntarily. You sell your field if you have no money. Otherwise, you need your field. So selling field, the fact that your kinsman has sold his field, means that something's wrong. He's short of money. So then the Torah goes on to say, well, you, the addressee here, your kinsman sells a field, you have the opportunity and even the obligation, perhaps, to redeem that field. Bring it back into the family. What if it still goes wrong? A kinsman borrows money. Now again, borrowing money means that he's short of money. We're not talking about, like, our modern economy runs on loans, right? That's how everything happens. Virtually everyone is in debt all the time, and many, many people are creditors at any given time. Or I guess institutions are creditors at any given time. But in a subsistence economy where most people are just trying to farm enough to live this year so that they can farm again next year, loans are not normal. I only need a loan if I'm opening a business, investing in something. Most people just want to make enough money this year to plant again next year. So why is someone taking out a loan? Well, again, things are going not well. I had a shortfall this year, right? I planted, but I don't have enough to cover my expenses. So I need to take out a loan. The idea is I'll take out a loan, I'll plant, next year will be more successful, I'll be able to pay back. Torah says, yeah, that's only going to work if there's no interest, right? If there's interest, there's no way that next year's produce is going to be significant enough to pay back, to make enough money and pay back last year's shortfall. So no interest. And then the Torah says, and this is the, these are the psukim you have in front of you on this slide. He sells himself to you. And I'll come back to that translation soon. He sells himself to you. Now, what does it mean he sells himself to you? So things have gone from bad to worse. He sold off his field already. He has no way of actually making money. He's taken out loans, tried to make it back, but is unsuccessful. How is he going to feed his family next year? So I have no money. I have no way of making money. I have no income. What do I do? Well, what I have is my labor, right? I have the power of my labor. So I go to someone who's doing well. I go to Rabbi Kelman. Rabbi Kelman founded Torah and Moshe, and he's a very, very wealthy guy. You know, so I go to Rabbi Kelman. Go to Rabbi Kelman. I say, Rabbi Kelman, listen, I know your estate is growing, right? Because, you know, all this real estate that's being sold by the people who are destitute, obviously someone's buying it. So who's this wealthy landowner? So I go to Rabbi Kelman. I say, Rabbi Kelman, you have all this real estate now, right? Now, you can't possibly on your own be working all of this land. How about this? I'll work for you. I'll work for you. In exchange, take care of me, right? Give me a place to live. Give me food. Make sure my family has food and clothing for the year, right? This is what we would call in American history, at least, an indentured servant, right? I will work for you, and I will get paid with subsistence. Like, I don't need cash. There was no cash in the ancient world anyway. I don't need cash. I just need to survive. So I'll trade you my labor for you taking care of me. And the Torah says, that's great. Nimkar lach. Don't work him like a slave, right? Lo ta'avod ba'avodat avod. Work him like a hired worker. K'sachir, k'doshav yeimach. And how long? Until the Yovel. Ad shnata Yovel. And then he goes free with his family, back to his land, and we'll come back to these details in a moment. And the Torah says, why? K'yavadayim, God says, right? Because they're my slaves. They can't be your slaves if they're my slaves. Okay, and now this is a part that's very troubling, but I'm not going to address today. Then the Torah contrasts it with non-Jewish slaves. V'avdecha v'amatecha asher yulach me'et ha'goyim asher svivotechem mehem tiknu eved v'ama, and they can be slaves forever. Those are real slaves. So that's where the Torah, we do have some moral problems with slavery in the Torah, not so much with Eved Ivri, but with Eved, what Chazal called Eved Kanani. But that's, I guess, fortunately for me, not our topic for tonight. So that's our second law, though. Second law, and again, hopefully you're already noticing these differences between the law in Mishpatim and the law in Bahar. They seem to be describing different realities and certainly have different laws. And then we keep turning, and we get to Devarim Tetvav. I'm sorry, I think I said Tetzayin before. It's Tetvav. The beginning of the parak, we have the rules of Shemitah again. And then the second half of the parak, we have again the rules of Eved Ivri, and we're going to fly through this and then zoom out. Ki yimacher lecha achicha ha'ivri o ha'ivriya va'avodcha sheshanim. So shall your, it's going to sound weird, but it's what it says, brother, male or female, they shall work for you for 6 years, and then in the seventh year, send them free. When you send them free, don't send them empty-handed. Instead, ha'anek ta'aniklo, give them stuff, animals, wine, oil, and so on. And remember that you were a slave. If the slave says, I don't want to leave, lo etzei me'imach, ki ayivcha, I love you, et betecha, ki tov lo imach. Now, the Torah, this law does not mention anything about the marriage case. So in this, it can't say, I love my wife, because that wasn't mentioned. It says, I love working here. No problem. Lakachta tamartzev and atata ba'uzno vadelet v'yalacha eved olam. So again, the martzeya in the door. Shouldn't be hard for you to do this, because he's worked double for you what a hired worker does. 6 years. And that's a pasuk yuchet there is, the Rishonim have a hard time understanding. There's a few different possibilities, but I'll leave it aside. I'll leave it aside for now. So what do we have here? Whether a slave is male or female, they work 6 years, and they go out chofshi in the seventh. Don't release them empty-handed. Instead, provide gifts. Remember that you too were slaves. If he wants to stay, pierce the ear at the door, he'll be a slave forever, and females too. And I should have emphasized that. It said at the beginning, ha'ivriyo ivriya, and then it says in Yud Zayin, V'af la'amatcha ta'aseh kein. Right? So let, in case you missed the subtle ha'ivri o ha'ivriya back in Pasuk Yudbet, the Torah repeats it in Pasuk Yudzayin. The martzeah thing, that works for an ama as well. Right? Females too. And this shouldn't be difficult for you because Mishneh Sechar Sachir, whatever that double thing is, in Pasuk Yudchet. Okay. So we've seen the three laws. Now, in order to think about how these go together, I want to drill a little bit deeper into, especially ours in Mishpatim, and think about really what the law is doing. So I'm not going to run through this, but I'll just make the observation. And you maybe pay attention. Maybe you have paid attention. I shouldn't pretend that I've noticed this and you haven't. When you read Mishpatim this week, that this is only true in Mishpatim, really, in the with the consistency that you see on the slide in front of you. In Mishpatim, laws are introduced with v'chi. V'chi yirivun anashim v'ikayish. V'chi yakei ish et avdo. V'chi natu anashim. V'chi yakei. New topics of laws, v'chi. Within a law, within a topic, the Torah then modifies it or introduces a variable for the law with im. And this is really consistent. You can see the pattern here, again, without running through the examples. V'china, I'm picking the middle one, Psukim Chavet and Kavgimo. V'china tu anashim, v'nakfu aisha hara, blah, blah, blah. So that's one law. V'im asoniyeh, right? So a variable, variation on that law. V'natat nefesh lacha nafesh. V'chi akeishet ein avdo v'et ein amato. V'im shein avdo shein amato yapil. So v'chi introduces the sort of major law. Im then introduces a sort of clause within the law, a variation within the law. Okay, one more preliminary point before we can really look at the laws of Eved Ivri a bit more carefully. We have, as you well know, we have lots of legal texts from the world of the Torah, some of which, this one happens to be about 600 years earlier than the Torah, but that's not really the point. It's the world of the Torah. This is called the laws. This is what I'm showing you here, the laws of Eshnunna. Probably the most famous such collection is the laws of Hammurabi, which are about 50 years later than the laws of Eshnunna, so about 1750 BCE, which are stylized very much like Mishpatim, right? Shuma, Awila, like if a man, something of another man, if a man hits another man, if an ox gores another ox. There's a lot to say about those comparisons. But I want to make just one point, and I learned this from my teacher, Barry Eichler, who is now retired from University of Pennsylvania and Yeshiva University, and on his way to living in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh. And but a long time ago, he wrote this really fantastic article on the literary structure and the laws of Eshnunna, where he made a very important point about how the laws are structured. So there's a lot of examples, but I'll just give you one. Laws of Eshnunna, paragraph 53 says, if a shor tam gores another ox to death, then there is a monetary punishment. Fine. If a shor, then paragraph 54, if a shor mu'ad gores a human to death, that's a capital crime, and the person has to pay. Has to die. Now, the details are actually very interesting, and we could compare the details of the laws of Eshnunna, the laws of Hammurabi, Mishpatim, with a lot of interesting results. But right now, I'm not so interested in the details. I'm interested actually in the structure. So, paragraph 53 had a short tom goring an ox. 54, that is, I should say, the most lenient case you can imagine of a goring ox, right? Because it's a short tom, not previously known to be violent, who gored an ox. So it's bad. I feel bad for the ox, but oxen are money, not human life. Paragraph 54 goes to the most serious case you can imagine. A shor mu'ad gores a human to death. Now, if you're reading this for law, right? If you're reading it as a jurist, you're like, wait a second, I have a lot of questions. But I have many, many questions. What about a shor tam who gored a person? Or a shor mu'ad who gored an ox? Like, you skipped a lot of things here, right? You went from like one extreme to another extreme. But you didn't tell me about all the in-between cases. There are lots of in-between cases I come up with. You went literally from one extreme to another extreme. And Eichler's point in that article is that that's actually exactly what the legal collections are often doing. They often go, I put the phrase that he uses on the top here, they often present polar cases with maximal variation. That's Eichler's phrase. And his point is that the laws are often organized not to tell you what the law is in every single case. In fact, they don't tell you what the law is in every single case. They tell you what the relevant variables are. So what do I learn from laws of Eshmita 5354? I learn that it matters if the ox is a shor tam or shor muad. In other words, I learn that it matters if the ox is known to be a gorer or not. That's one important variable. And I learn that it matters if the victim is an ox or a human, that's another important variable. Now, what's the law when you mix and match and you fill in your chart and you're like, well, what if it's a shor tam and a human or a shor muad and an ox? So I don't know. The laws of Mishnah didn't tell me the answers. It just told me what the right questions to ask are. That here are important variables. Okay, so that's my second preliminary. Now, let's go back to Mishpatim. And we look at the literary makeup of the first 10 psukim, right, from Bet to Yud Aleph, the law of Eved Ivri and Amai Ivriya, and we notice that they are highly structured. So both of them start with ki, right, the ki tikneh Eved Ivri, ki yimkor ish et bitola ama. Each of them then starts, I'm sorry, then include three variations on the main law, im, v'im. I'll ignore the vavs for right now. So they're structured as a key main clause followed by three variations, each of the halves is. The first law begins, sheshanim yavod, yitzei lachofshi chinam, yitzei lachofshi chinam. The last one, pasuk yud aleph, the amai v'riyah ends, v'yatzah chinam. The last pasuk of the Eved Ivri ends, he says, lo etzei chofshi, va'avodo le'olam. And then the Amai Ivriya begins, lo tetzei ketzei ta'avadim. So there's all sorts of fancy words we could use to describe the structure. I don't really care to describe it in any detail. I just want to point out that it's highly structured. This is obviously not just written for clarity of legal detail, but written for literary structure. So we have our two major laws. The first one ends and the last one begins. I'm sorry, the first one begins and the last one ends with the same clauses, and they're linked by the same words. The important point, and I want to go back to the Eichler for a second, the important point is going in here, if I know how to read ancient Near Eastern laws, if I know how to read ancient Near Eastern laws, I should be expecting polar cases with maximal variation. I expect to find, not every single case, but I expect to find cases where you have two laws juxtaposed to each other, where the whole point is to show that these are vastly different. And think about the differences here. Now, what's different here? Well, when you think about it, they're entirely different. Sorry, but they're entirely different. That first one, we have to come back to the question of why he's a slave. I want to come back to that in a couple of minutes. But the first one is a slave, clearly not for the reason that the girl is a slave in the second part. Why is she a slave in the second part? It's explicit. She's being sold into slavery in order to be married. In order to be married. That might sound like a horrible thing to do. But again, you have to remember, and this is where thinking about the ancient context is very significant. So you can imagine this in modern times as well, but certainly in ancient times, think about a family. It gives the right to sell to the father who do not have the money for things like dowries, much less fancy weddings. And so they are legitimately concerned about the future of their daughter. Now, remember inheritance laws in the Torah, the land's going to go to the son. Sons, whatever it may be. What are the daughters going to do? How will they be cared for? We need to make sure that they're married off. This is literally the definition of a patriarchal society, right? I know today we use it in a in a moral sense, and a social sense. But when we talk about an ancient economy, we mean literally the father is in charge of the money of the household. We don't have to like it. It's just a historical fact in the ancient Near East. So the father is worried about his daughter. The way for a girl to make sure that she's set up for life is to make sure she's married off so that she can join someone else's household, because she will not have any role in her own parents' household once she is of marriageable age and her brothers inherit. So where is she going to be? She needs to be married. If they don't have money for a dowry, how is she going to have a husband? This is an answer. I think the word slave is accurate, but sometimes colors this in a overly negative way. But essentially, the father says to another man, again, a wealthy man in town, and says, look, I have this fantastic daughter. Right now, she's young, right? She's not of marriageable age, but she can start working in a household. She's a kid, right? And again, it's going to sound cruel. She's 9 years old. She's 6 years old. I don't know. She can start doing chores. How about this? You buy her, meaning she moves to your household. You provide for her. You give her a home. You give her food. You give her clothes. You're responsible for her. And the deal is she will not be a slave for life. Once she's of marriageable age, either you or your son will marry her. Right? That's what we get from the psukim. I'll go back quickly to the psukim. The assumption was that he would marry her. And Pasuk Chet says, what if he doesn't want to? Right? She was betrothed to him. What if he doesn't want to marry her? Fair question. We have to worry about that. Right? He can betroth her to his son. But the idea is, as a father, I have cared for my daughter by making sure that she has a home, and eventually she will be a wife and mother, and she will have the care that she needs to live as an adult woman, not on her own, because that's what the concern is. So it's selling. Again, I don't love the word selling, but it's not inaccurate. It's just that it makes it sound like we're dealing with a southern slave market, which is not the case. Again, it's not wrong, but it's not the purpose, and it's an entirely different sense of why someone is being sold. There's also probably no money involved. So the master takes her in, cares for her, provides for her, and promises that eventually she will marry someone in the household. Of course, the Torah also worries in that last case, like, what if not? Right? Im shlosh elu lo yaseh, v'yatzach inam in kasef. Then she doesn't have to buy herself back. She simply goes free. But this is the second case. The second case is a father selling his daughter for the purposes of marriage. What about the first case? Well, the first case also talks about marriage, right? Now, it's specifically about a man who is sold as an Eved Ivri, and tells us also about marriage, but tells us, what does it say about marriage? It tells us that marriage doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything for him. If he comes in single or married, he goes out single or married. If he marries while he's there, he marries a slave. That doesn't change her status, doesn't change his status. Right? Marriage is irrelevant for the male slave, but it's everything for this particular female slave. And I want to emphasize this particular, because we'll see in a bit that there are other types of female slaves. But this particular male slave and this particular female slave, this is the polar case of the maximal variation. They are entirely different cases. The girl was sold into slavery by her father for the purposes of marriage. And so the entire law is about how to make sure that her marriage is in fact taken care of. Whereas for the man, when we think about it, it's actually really bizarre. There's very little in the law of Eved Ivri here, except for the question of his spouse. What happens if he's not married? What happens if he is married? What happens if he gets married there? As if that's the most burning question about Eved Ivri, like what's his marital status? But of course, that's not the most burning question. That's simply the point that the Torah wants to make in this particular contrast. So these two laws are selected. And here's the key point that I want to make. They're selected from out of many, many other slave laws that are also possibly to be legislated. many kinds of slaves, but these two laws are selected to make one particular point. In the case of this male slave, marriage makes no difference to his status. In the case of this female slave, marriage is what it's all about. Okay. So that's point one. And of course, we haven't talked anything about these contradictions yet. So now let's think about some of those. So this is just the same psukim from Vayikra, a little bit more context. I'm not going to read them again, but that ki amu chachicha, what happens if your brother is destitute? And here I want to think, the reason I put this back up is because I want to think about what kind of slave this actually is. So a little while ago, when I was first introducing the case in Bihar, I told you about this farmer who's not doing well, finds himself in a downward spiral, right? A bad year, sells all some of his land, another bad year, takes out some loans, can't pay it back, winds up losing everything, and finds out he has nothing to do other than to indenture himself, to sell his labor in exchange for housing and food and clothing. That already is a very important observation. It's not my observation, it's sort of, I think everyone observes this, but it's a very important observation about what the slave is doing. When the pasuk says, "Ki amu chachicha imach v'nimkar lach," Chazal already say this, and I think this is absolutely pshat. B'mocher atzmo hakatuv medaber. What is v'nimkar lach? He sells himself. He voluntarily goes to someone and says, "Listen, I will trade my labor for housing, food, and clothing." No one else is selling him. This is not the court selling him into slavery. It's not a debtor's prison. He is saying, "Look, I don't have any alternatives here. I literally cannot support my family. The only way I can do this is to get someone else to support my family, and I will trade my labor for that support." Now, once we say that, we realize, like, okay, what would happen if he sold himself? Hypothetically, in year 13 of the Yovel cycle, he sold off his land already. He's in debt already. Now he sells his own labor. And let's say hypothetically someone came along and said, "Okay, but 6 years from now you go free." So 6 years later, his master sets him free. What happens? Well, the answer is nothing. He's going to sell himself again. He has no way of supporting himself. He's sold off his land. He's in debt. He has no options here. Setting him free is pointless. When does it make sense to set this guy free? Only at the Yovel. Because at Yovel, so the debts were canceled at Shemitah already, but what happens at Yovel? He gets his land back. Right? Yovel is this massive reset button on the entire agricultural economy. All the lands that were sold go back to their original owners. That means this poor guy who has been working away for the last 37 years on someone else's field literally gets a fresh start. No debt, real estate goes back to him, and he goes free. It only makes sense to set him free at Yovel. It makes no sense to set him free before that, because the whole reason he's in slavery, quote unquote, is because he has no money, he has no land. That's the cycle that Bahar has been describing. He's already sold off his land, he's already gone into debt. There's no options for him other than to work for someone else. And until Yovel, that's not going to get better. Come Yovel, fresh start. Of course, if someone's really been working for 37 years, probably it's his son who's going to have a fresh start rather than him. But that's fine. The family gets a fresh start. What about in our parsha, though, in Mishpatim? So we're not told why the Eved Ivri has become an Eved. Chazal tell us, let me skip to this. Chazal tell us, and I'll come back to the other points, Ki tikne Eved Ivri. This is not someone who sells himself. This is someone sold by the courts because he stole. The stealing is, let's say, Dibera Midrash Behoveh. But he ran up a lot of debts. He cannot pay back his debts. And the courts come in and say, "Look, you can't pay your debts. You have a lot of debts. You're going to have to work off your debts by working for this person." The Midrash, this is in the Mechilta. The Mechilta says, How do I know that? Oh, no, maybe it's someone who sells himself. No. That parish in Bahar, that's Mocher Atzmo. Hare Mocher Atzmo Amur. Hamata Mudlamar Kitikne Evid Ivri. What about Kitikne Evid Ivri? Binim Kar Bevetin Al Gnevato Aktub Medaber. So the Midrash says there's two different kinds of Evid Ivri. Two different ways that a guy wound up as an Evid Ivri. One type of person is someone who sold himself, because he realized he's destitute, he has no options. Another person was sold by the courts to pay off his debts. To pay off his debts. Rashbam, the ultimate Pashtan, I know you've had Dr. Lakshin speak for you, the great expert on Rashbam. So Rashbam, the ultimate Pashtan, says, yeah, that's exactly right. Ki tikne evid ivri, this is on the beginning of our parsha. B'mecharuhu beit din ha-ketuv b'daber. Right? Again, paraphrasing the Midrash, this is the case of a court selling someone. How do I know? It says later on in Mishpatim, the beginning of Perakav Bet, that that is in fact something that the courts do. If someone steals and doesn't have enough to pay back, remember, if you steal, depending on what you steal and when, if I steal at night, suddenly I have to pay back double. Right? So if I stole something that cost $1 million at night, I have to pay back $2 million. Now, if I had $2 million sitting around, I probably wouldn't have stolen that first $1 million. Actually, I don't know if that's true. That seems to be not true. But anyway, now I don't have $2 million to pay back. So I owe a lot of debts. So the Torah says, "Emein lo v'nim karav nevato." You can be sold to pay off your debts. Of a mocher atzmo ba'aniyuto, but someone who sells himself for his poverty, k'tiv b'parshat Bahar Sinai ki amucha chesav v'nim karav. And then the Rashbam says, And this is the Rashbam's addition. Rashbam says, and that's the answer to this first alleged contradiction. How long is a slave a slave? How long is a slave a slave? Depends what kind of slave you're talking about. Uktiv bo ad shnata yovel ya'avod imach. Someone who sells himself because he's destitute, doesn't have land, doesn't have money, only goes free at yovel. Because what's the point of setting him free before yovel? There's nothing to do. You're just going to go back to being impoverished. Uvikan omer, but someone who's sold by the courts to pay off debts, sheshanim ya'avod. And what does that mean? That means maximum sheshanim ya'avod. Even if my debt is $1 million and my labor is only worth $50,000 a year, 6 years and no more. Right? The master can't say, $1 million, $50,000 a year, that means 20 years. No, Torah says. If you're sold to pay off your debts, 6 years and no more. Can you get out early? In fact, you can. The Mishnah says so. The Mishnah says, Evid Ivri konet asmo begir own kesef, by paying off your debts, right? So what if my debt was only $75,000 and my labor is worth $50,000 a year? Okay, so a year and a half from now, I'm free. It's a maximum of 6 years. Maximum 6 years. But again, the key point, and I think this is absolutely pshat. So the Chazal say this. Chazal also say other things. I'm not going to worry right now about Chazal, but Chazal do say there's two different cases of slavery here. And Rashbam points out that solves the problem of how long is a slave a slave. One kind of slave, the kind of slave who's sold by the courts to pay off the debt, that's the maximum 6 years. Another kind of slave, a slave who sells himself because he has no options, that goes to Yovel. He wouldn't want to be out before that. Now, if we sum this up, we have three, we've just talked about three different kinds of slavery in biblical Israel. This wife slavery, a daughter sold by her father to work and then be married. Debt slavery one, the guy who sells himself, right? He's like, I don't have any money. So I'm gonna sell off my labor in exchange for being cared for. And debt slavery too, which is involuntary. Right? The courts come in and sell a person in order to pay off the debts. These are all in the Torah. Well, they're all in Tanakh. They're all in the Torah, in fact. So wife slavery, that's the second law in Mishpatim. Debt slavery one, explicit, right? Im ein lo v'nim kar b'gnevato. That's also, oh, I messed this up. I'm sorry. I mean, come on, don't post this. I'm going to have to fix this before I'll send you a corrected version. That's also the case at the beginning of Mishpatim, not Vayikra. Someone who's sold off by the courts in order to pay back their debts. Debt slavery too. I know what I messed up, but anyway, I'll fix it. Debt slavery too. So we actually have this. It's mentioned in a story in Tanakh. It's kind of a terrible story. The beginning of Malachim Bet, Perek Dalid, where Elisha has his students, his Bnei HaNeviim. One of his students has died, and the wife of one of his students comes to him and says, "Listen, my husband's dead. He was a Yirei Elokim, as you know. And listen to this phrase: V'hanoshe balakachet et shnei ladai lo la'avadim. And the creditor is coming to take my two sons as slaves." So she needs help from Elisha. And Elisha helps, and that's why we have the story. But I'm not so interested in the solution, I'm interested in the problem right now. Right? This seems to have been a reality in biblical Israel. Someone is in debt, the creditor can come in and with the help of the courts, actually take a kid from the family, in this case, maybe because the father is dead already, and work off those debts. Work off those debts. And that's the beginning of Mishpatim as well. Someone who's mocher nimkar bevet din. Okay, so we've really sorry. Let me go back a bit. So we've really solved. I apologize. We really solved a good amount of the basic problems here. Right? So if we go back to our inconsistencies. Let's start with the ones that we've explicitly talked about. How long a slave? 6 years, Shemot and Dvarim, or until Yovel Vayikra? Right, of course, because there are two different kinds of slaves. Now, let me talk very, very briefly, and then I'm going to have to wrap up here with the question of the first one I put up here, the female slave. So another inconsistency that we noticed was that in Shemot, we contrast the Eved Ivri with the Amah Ivriya. But in Dvarim, it says, Ki tikne achicha, Ha'ivri o ha'ivriya. Va'avarcha she'shanim. And then the whole marzeh also. Va'afla matcha ta'asekein. So, well, what's the right answer? Is a woman work for 6 years and then go out free, as it says in Dvarim? Or does a woman get married to her master and only go out free if the master doesn't marry her, as it says in Shmot? And the answer is, either of them is possible. Neither of those was meant to be a comprehensive statement of all kinds of slavery available for women. As if available for women is like a good thing. Yeah, slavery has been available for women as well. A victory for feminism. We have in Shemot, we have one particular type of female slavery. Right? If a father sells his daughter to be a slave to a master such that she will be married. That's not the only type of slavery available for a female. But Shemot didn't give us all the kinds of slavery available for a female. Shemot gave us two cases, remember, right? Polar cases with maximal variation. One case of a male slave, one case of a female slave where it's all about marriage. Dvarim says, hold on. We can fill in one of those gaps. What we didn't tell you back in Shemot is that first model is also available for females, right? What happens if a woman steals $1 million? Why should only men be thieves who go into debt and are sold by courts? Absolutely, a woman can do that as well. A woman can run up lots of debts and the court can step in and sell a woman off as a slave. In that case, Dvarim says, well, that's the same as an Eved Ivri. What does gender have to do with this? That case, maximum 6 years, Marzeya, and so on, right? In other words, of course that's the same thing. We didn't talk about it in Shemot because Shemot was focused on making one contrast between the Eved Ivriya and this particular type of Amah Ivriya. But I can fill in another case in Dvarim. Absolutely, there is also a case of a female Eved Ivri, so to speak, female six-year slave. Totally could be filled in. Other things we won't have time to talk about now. I'll mention very briefly and then I'll wrap this up. So one contradiction or apparent contradiction is Shemot says V'gisho el ha-Elohim for the Marzea ritual. Bring him to the Elohim. Now, what is Elohim? I wasn't even sure how to write it on the slide. Is it Elohim? Is it a hyphen? Is it God? Is it a court? Chazal take it to be a court. Whereas Dvarim doesn't say anything about bringing him to anywhere. Instead says, V'gisho el ha-Delet. And in context, it actually sounds like you bring the slave to the door of the house where you and the slave live. And of course, that has a obvious symbolism to it, because if the slave is saying, I don't want to go free, so you bring me to the doorway and you pierce my ear into the mezuzah, even if it's just temporarily, you have literally nailed me to the doorway and said, look, now I'm a avado le'olam, right? So I belong to this house forever. So that has great symbolism, but that's clearly not what Shmot says. Shmot says, V'gisho el Elohim. So what's an Elohim? So it's a fair question. I'm not entirely sure what the right answer is. Most modern commentators take an Elohim to be God. Bring him to God. The Midrash makes a big deal about the Marzea not being symbolically nailing him to the doorway, but instead being a punishment. So God needs to be there because God wants to punish the Eved. Something like, there's different variations in different parts of Chazal, but something like, I said, I took you out of Mitzrayim so you would be my slave, but here you said, I want to be this person's slave. So let the ear who heard at Har Sinai, ki avadayhem, now be pierced as a punishment. Now again, that totally changes the understanding of what this Marzea is doing. It's not symbolically nailing them to the doorway. Instead, it's a punishment. Why is that not in Dvarim? Well, some people have suggested, the Mishnah in Zvachim says that before Yerushalayim is built, before the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim is built, I'm sorry, bamot are allowed throughout the land, the whole series of Mishnayot there in the last parak of Zvachim. And perhaps Shmot's imagining a case where bringing an Eved to El HaElohim, in other words, to a bama, to Hashem, not an illicit bama, to bama to Hashem, is plausible. There's a bama in my town, there's a bama in the next town. Maybe that's where I go, it's symbolically a punishment, and that's the point. But in Devarim, of course, Devarim makes a very big deal about there being only one place where there could be a mikdash, starting in Perek Yudbet, right, and over, b'makom asher yivchar Hashem. Therefore, meat changes, therefore lots of things are different in Devarim than in the reality envisioned in Shmot and Vayikra. So Dvarim might say, okay, look, at that point, you know, if we're talking about a world in which there's only one place, Elohim is only in Yerushalayim, and I live up in Tzipori, it's not reasonable to bring the slave down to Yerushalayim. So, okay, there's no local Bama, now just bring him to the door. So it changes it. Maybe, I'm not sure, but I'll throw that out as a possibility. Open question, which I'll leave here, why does Dvarim, only Dvarim talks about Ha'anaka, right, these gifts at the end, ha'anek ta'aniklo. Why is that not in Shmot? I don't think it's a very hard question. I don't know that Shmot has to give you all the laws. Again, Shmot's focused only on the question of marriage, but it's an open question. The key is I'll wrap up with this. The key is that, and really the most important part that I want you to take away from this is not any of the details that we've run through here about what slavery was like and the different models of slavery. As important as those may be for understanding the different psukim and the different cases. The key is really that when we read the laws, and Mishpatim is a fantastic place to do this, we have to recognize that the laws are a selection of laws and that the point being made is rarely the law itself. The law itself is teaching us something, either by way of contrast or by way of innovation or by way of enshrining a particular value. But this is not a code of law that is comprehensive and tells us everything. So, I mean, in the case of Ha'anaka, for example, I don't even think it's an interesting question why Devarim talks about Ha'anaka and Shmot doesn't. Shmot doesn't tell us 98% of what I would need to do in order to actually have an Eved Ivri. So no Ha'anaka, fine. There's a lot of other things missing also. But that's the key point. Not so much the Ha'anaka question as much as the methodological question. What that does is really focus our attention on what is in the text. Right, so rather than saying like, what would the case be in that? We're like, why does the Torah choose these laws? How does the Torah arrange these laws? Right, how does the Torah present the laws? We get to things like the, you know, our parsha has what become known as the Arba'ah Avot Nezikin. or the Arba'a Shomrim. All of these are in our parsha, but they're not presented in the way that the Mishnah would present them. Right? The Mishnah, which is a code of law, says there are four Shomrim. You should know about them. Right? There are four Avot Nezikim. Let me tell you about them. The Torah doesn't do that. How does the Torah present it? What points and values are being made by the way that the Torah presents the laws? That's a literary question, but it's a literary question with, I think, great hashkafic and ideological significance. And that's really what the Torah is doing with its laws. I'll have to end with that.
What's your answer? Why doesn't the Torah? I mean, there are a few questions. You can look in the chat box before you do that. So I Rick, the Torah does not present the four Shomrim, and it doesn't say Shorborm, Abahaver, etc. Yeah, do you have a 1 minute short synopsis? I know that's unfair, but you know, you set yourself up for it. So
let me just see this. Yes. Okay, so most of these are really good, and I think, you know, people could probably answer them themselves. What's the answer to the Avot Nezikin? No, I think it's actually a long question. Meaning, I think the most important thing right now is to ask the questions. I think they're not obvious questions, right? I think we often read them and say like, oh, sure, that's Bor. Right? So yes, on one level, that is Bor. But why is Bor here? Like, why are these Nezikin, why are they being chosen? They're not actually listed in four in a row, right? They're broken up in between. At the beginning of Perek Kaf Bet, we have an interruption in the Nezikin. So it's probably not even fair to say that the Torah presents the Arba'an of Avot Nezikin. You have to sort of pick and choose. So this is really a question, not an answer. I mean that sincerely. It really would be a whole different shir,
okay.
But
I'm sorry,
you know, I
drew it up for a future shir. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm sure at the end of Shabbos, everyone here will have thoughts on that, and next year you can have someone here give a shir on those topics.
All right. You want to touch upon any of the questions in the chat box?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I think some of these are more observations, but the Amma, it's true. It doesn't say explicitly that the father is Jewish, but I think it's not only do Chazal take it as obvious, but I think it is the Pshat obvious. So we don't have any slaves in Shemot. There are no non-Jewish slaves. So we do get that considered in Vayikra, but not in Shemot. And I think the contrast there is specifically about the father marrying off his daughter, I think within Israelite society.
Because in Dvarim, it's Ivri and Ivriya, and it's not.
Right.
The word Amma is not even used. So I'm just wondering if there's a difference between an Amma and an Ivriya.
That's a really good question. So Chazal used the words Amma and Shifcha differently. They use Shifcha for the non-Jew and Amma for the Jew. In Tanakh, that clearly doesn't work out. I mean, you have lots of Shvachot who are Jewish. And it's not entirely clear that there is a difference semantically between Amma and Shifcha in Biblical Hebrew. You actually have this funny inscription from the 8th century. So from Yeshayahu's time in Silwan, across from Ir David. A tomb inscription where a man writes something like "Ein po kesef zahav," right? Of course, because he doesn't want anyone to plunder his tomb. So he says "Ein po kesef zahav ki im." He already named himself ki im atzmotav ve'atzmot amato, but only his bones and the bones of his ama. And it's like, is that ama like his maidservant? That would be weird. Is Amma also a term used for a wife? Is she this kind of Amma who was then married to him? Like, in other words, a debt slave who became married to him? Plausible, but unfortunately, like, inscriptions are always fascinating, but they never come with answer keys. There. Anyway, all right. If a Hebrew enters into slavery with his Jewish wife, can Jewish master still give him a non-Jewish slave woman as a mate? Biblical law, yes. Whether anyone will want that or not, a different question. At the end of a Shemitah cycle, debts get canceled. Right, exactly. So the debts would have been canceled at Shemitah, but the real estate doesn't come back until Yovel. And that's the big difference, right? So you can go out debt-free, but have nothing to do. And there's just no way to make a living. So Yovel is it's crazy how radical Yovel is, right? I mean, all of the real estate that I've accumulated in the last 49 years suddenly goes back to its previous owners. Like an insane.
I was wondering about the debt that he became a slave over. Does that debt, the reason that that debt's
at
the end of Shemitah is because the debt does too.
So that's a great point, and that raises an interesting question, because especially in Devarim Tetvav, the first half of the perek is about Shemitah, and then we move to Eved Ivri. And both of them are 6 years followed by 7 years, but allegedly different kinds of cycles, right? The 6 years of Eved Ivri is a personal 6 years, whereas a Shemitah is a national 6 years, right? But I think your point's a great point. It's like, it's almost too tempting to conclude that. Like, how could this not be the same 6 years? Doesn't it make good sense? Exactly like you said, like, let the Eved go out at Shemitah, because even if it was only 2 years, the debt's canceled. So that's a really interesting question. It becomes a hard. So Chazal don't buy that. I think it's not a bad reading, actually, of the Psukim. Chazal insists that that's not true. It also is harder in Shmot to sustain that, where there is no Shemitah mentioned. So Sheshanim Yavod is sort of clearly personal 6 years, not those 6 years that we were just talking about. On the Shemitah side, it's not entirely clear which kind of debts are canceled. So if I stole, do those debts get canceled? Again, biblical law, not halacha. Do those debts get canceled? There's only if I borrowed money that that debt gets canceled. So that also affects this, right? Because the case in Mishpatim in Chaf Bet is Gneva, b'mein lo v'nimkar b'gnevato. So if that debt wouldn't get canceled, then that won't help for the 7 years and going out. But that is there's a lot to think about there, actually. And the connection between Shemitah and Eved Ivri can't just be a coincidence, because the like Dvarim really puts them back to back. So there's clearly something going on that we could think more about. And then the last one, the wife is given to Eved Ivri in Shemot, is not the young girl option to the owner, is it? Right. That is, I think, correct. So the first rule, the first law assumes probably a non-Jewish assumes, right? So I said to Sima a minute ago that we don't get the laws of a non-Jewish slave. It seems to just assume that this master also has non-Jewish female slaves around. He can marry them off. So that's certainly how Chazal take it. That it's a Shifcha Kna'anit who's being married to Eved Ivri, which is legally interesting then, right? Because Chazal are like, oh, an Eved Ivri, who's fully a Jew, is suddenly allowed to marry his non-Jewish slave woman. And they have to sort of theorize that and figure out why that's okay. But I think that's right. It's not the Amai Ivriya. The Amai Ivriya, really the whole point, right? So if you think about it from a parent's perspective, you're selling this girl to a wealthy family. You have set her up as well as possible. She's going to marry the father or the son in this well-to-do family. So he certainly, it would be a betrayal of that if he suddenly married her off to a slave, right? That's really not the rule. If he doesn't marry her or marry her off to a son, then tetzei chofshi ein kasev, right? She gets to go free because that was the deal. The deal is she's going to be the wife. Now, going back to the first question, one of the previous questions from Zoom user, he can't be sure that she'll be his only wife, right? So she's not necessarily going to be the woman of the household, but she will be a wife of a well-to-do landowner. And that's no small thing for a poor family to accomplish for their daughter. So again, there's a lot of harsh realities here that are a bit uncomfortable to think of, but they also, once you think about them, you realize what the Torah is actually trying to do. So they're trying to grapple with these realities. Given the realities, how can the laws actually take care of people?
What's so good about her having to go out free? She's then
No,
stuck
not the
the worst
problem.
thing.
Yeah,
Even
that's a
worse than
problem.
before.
Agreed. That things have gone wrong at that point. The Torah just makes sure that she doesn't get, for example, sold off into slavery to someone else or married off to a slave, right? The Torah's like, look, you have two choices. You marry her off to a son. If you're not doing that, then you have to set her free. You're absolutely right. She is going to be in a rough situation then, but at least she's not in bondage.
Well, I don't know. If we're saying that the bondage is just that he has to take care of her in thanks for her doing chores, whatever, she's probably better off doing that than going free
Yeah, well, at least now
in
she's
those
not slaves.
days.
I'm not really disagreeing with you. I think that's true, and I think that's again sort of harsh realities. But she's a free agent, right? So it means she can go indenture herself if she wants. But it's and she might wind up doing that. You're right. He can't sell her to someone else, right? He can't say like, ah, now you're my slave forever. I'm just going to sell you. So that can't happen. But you're absolutely right. She's going to be in a rough spot, no matter what, at that point.
I'll have to ask one more question. The pasuk says Imra'a be'enei Adoneha. What does that mean? Imra'a, if she is not, if she's bad in his eyes, or if the situation is bad in his eyes. It's a ra'a with, it's not ra be'enei, it's
Right.
ra'a.
Yeah, I think it has to be that she is. I think
That
that's
she doesn't find favor in his eyes or
something
whatever,
like
but
that.
it's strong language, it seems to me.
That's true. That's true. I don't know. I hadn't thought that much about what would make her, what the stakes would be. But I guess if we ask, like, from his perspective, what would be so bad about marrying her? What does he lose? I mean, so wives cost money. It's possible he just doesn't have the money for it. And that's one of the things that I think the Torah is concerned about. But otherwise, why not marry her? So wives provide domestic labor. There's, obviously the conjugal relationship. There's, what's the downside? So I don't know. Maybe that's just what the Torah is saying. Like, yeah, I mean, Imra'a be'enei, like, it's not working out. Like, he does not want her in the household. But I'm not sure. I'm really not sure about that. It's a good question.
Okay, I think we can let you go. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Oh, pleasure.
All these questions, more questions than answers, and that means it's a good shiur. And
Oh.
food to think about and stuff to think about. So thank you. Of course, next week we'll actually welcome we'll welcome Shayna Kravitz, making her debut for Torah Motion. She lives here in Toronto. We'll introduce her next week. Give me the shiur, please, God, and the parsha. Tomorrow, of course, my parsha on the my shiur on the Seder 9:15. We're gonna start. We just finished the Shema. We'll start Emet v'Yatziv, the last the bracha leading up to Shmoneh Esrei. And Sunday, of course, Rabbi Liebtag and Dr. Gesundheit will not be giving the regular shiurim because of our program on coping and resilience, beginning at 9:15, a 5-hour program, 9 speakers. If come to part of it, should be an important program. That's all I can say at this time. And Mark Shapiro, of course, is also not teaching. He's in Japan, so he will not be teaching this week. And Nati Helfgott is going to Israel to visit his son who just made Aliyah, so he will not be teaching this week. So I guess a slightly different week than usual, but hopefully we'll have lots to learn from. And thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kohler. We look forward to learning with you in the future, and all the best, and wish everybody well. Laila Tov and Shabbat Shalom and all good things. B'sorah Tova. Thank you very much. Laila Tov.